You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the National League West. As we enter the final few weeks of the regular season, things haven't changed that much in that the Dodgers are still on top of the West Division with the Giants in second place. But what's changed a little bit is the gap between the two teams. So as we see, the Dodgers are doing pretty well, and they've gotten through a tough part of their schedule, and now they're moving on to a lot of games against non-contenders. But the games that they do have left that might be difficult are, of course, against their division rival, the San Francisco Giants, who seem to have put together a nice run and are really have positioned themselves to possibly grab this division title. So I think, as we all thought maybe even 4 months ago, the Dodgers and the Giants race will probably come down to the last weekend of the season, and it should be an interesting ride from here until then. Let's bring in Ken Gernick, who covers the Dodgers for MLB.com. And Ken, as we're looking here, it seems to be that the walking wounded are healing. The team is coming together. The big ones recently, with Ryu being activated and having a really good start against the Padres, and then Uribe was also activated for the disabled list and had a nice game on Sunday. So let's just talk about that a little bit. With everything starting to come together, the team looked largely the way that they wanted it to, even when the season started. So that's got to be good news for the Dodgers.
Yeah, they seem to have survived the storm, at least physically. They seem to be healthy. They're not playing all that well right now. They've lost a few games. They did get that win out of Ryu, which was, that was a boost, at least morally. So now they have Uribe back. They have Hanley Ramirez back. So they got the left side of the infield. They were both on the disabled list. But, Hanley's he's a puzzle to them right now. He really hasn't had a good season. He's played hurt most of the season. And has pretty much refused to go on the disabled list to get healthy because he's playing for a contract. So that really hasn't worked out well for either Hanley or the team. But their pitching is now healthy with Ryu back, and Zach Greinke seems to have at least figured out how to deal with his tender elbow, and he's pitched well. And, of course, they got Clayton Kershaw, shooting maybe for an MVP award. So they feel they're, at least physically, they're in as good a shape as they could possibly be for September. And as you pointed out, the schedule is not really a backbreaker thanks to being in the NL West. So they feel they're in about as good a shape as they can be right now for the stretch run.
It's an interesting point because I've always kind of grappled with this, just covering a beat for several years and just, there's just a fine line. And, of course, now that it's September, it's not as urgent for a player to maybe go on the disabled list for the betterment of the team to get an actual player who, a healthy player who can actually help the team win. But, before rosters expand, it is a kind of a sensitive issue because in one respect, you have a player who's got a great track record and a great history and has helped his team in the past and can definitely make a difference. But is that player really that valuable if he's a player that's hurt and can't really perform? And I know it's a pride thing with a lot of these guys. And does that make it kind of hard from a manager standpoint? Sometimes they have to make a decision that's not popular with the player. But, where do you see that as far as when a player is trying to push through something and doesn't want to go on the disabled list? And when does that start hurting the team?
Yeah, well, using Hanley as an example, it's a lot easier to make that call in hindsight than it is when, you don't know how serious the injury is or how much it will affect him. And from the manager's viewpoint, I know Don Mattingly has often said he'd rather have Hanley in the lineup for the sake of what it might make the other team do. I mean, they respect that bat. They figure if he's in the lineup, he's dangerous. They don't know how badly he's hurt. They don't know that if the pitcher makes a mistake, he'll be able to hit one 400 feet or not. So it's easy after a month of playing hurt and you look at him and he hasn't driven in any runs to say, yeah, well, they should have gone on the disabled list and replaced him, with a healthy player. But at the time, especially with these nagging injuries, you don't know if it's a day or a week or a month. And unfortunately, in Hanley's case, it's been closer to a month where you play less than 100%, and it does affect the team because you're not that force in the lineup. And the other teams eventually, they figure it out and they start exploiting him because they know that he can't do what he could do if he's physically 100%. And the net result is the offense struggles, and that's what's happened on and off with the Dodgers this year.
And the problem also is when you have a contending team and you're sort of they're planning on being around deep into October, if you've got something nagging, I mean, that's not just going to heal itself if you're not giving it a proper time to heal. And then you're talking, I mean, we're at September, you know, early September right now, and if they still want to be around on October 20th, that's a really long time to continue on with this, and you would think that maybe shutting it down, just getting it right for the sake of October would make a little bit of sense too.
Well, and that's what they did in August, and he was out for 2 weeks with an oblique. But that was after missing 30 starts during the season when he didn't go on the disabled list. So you had to figure if he missed 30 starts along the way, he probably should have been disabled at some point during the season too. But anyway, now they figure after this stint on the disabled list, he's about as healthy as he's going to be. And now it's a question of whether he can produce, whether he puts too much pressure on himself to produce, knowing that this is kind of his not only the stretch run for the team to make the postseason, but his stretch run to get a contract.
And let's talk about a player who seemingly is healthy and just isn't doing much production-wise with Yasiel Puig. So he was dropped to sixth in the batting order, which is also another area that it seems like it would be a really easy thing for a manager to do, but there's all kinds of factors around that. It's a sensitive topic. If the player takes it hard, you know, players obviously, from what I'm reading, Puig seems to be a little bit frustrated, or that's at least how Don Mattingly described it. They've dropped to the sixth in the order, and that can kind of have effects if Puig isn't totally on board with that. Does he seem to be receptive to that, and is that did you see that as a pretty sound move?
Well, you know, the funny thing about Puig is even though he's starting outfielder in the All-Star game, he really hasn't been the same player since June. I mean, he had a phenomenal May, and that got him into the All-Star game, but he's been a shadow of himself. He's had only I think, two home runs in the last 6 or 7 weeks, which you would never imagine with the publicity that he gets because he's kind of a lightning rod in a lot of ways. He gets a lot of highlight films for spectacular plays. But as far as being a solid, everyday, consistent player, that's not what he's been for the last 2 months. So I don't, and he knows it. He hasn't complained about not only being dropped in the lineup, but even getting a few days off. I think not only is he frustrated, but I think the team is frustrated because they need his bat. And he just hasn't provided any production at all in these last 2 months. I could see them, using Scott Van Slyke more often if necessary, if Puig doesn't start producing.
So there was an interesting happening a few days ago in the 12th inning against the Padres. the shift has been a popular topic, not just in certain teams, but really with everybody. The shift has sort of taken off, with some teams doing a little bit more than others. But this was extreme. They did basically all of the infielders on the right side of the infield. Kind of looked like a soccer game, protecting the goal in penalty kicks. And just because Seth Smith from the Padres is a Deadpool hitter, and it's the 12th inning, and they want to win this game. So what were you thinking when, I guess, Tim Wallach, this was his idea, and it seemed to be a pretty sound idea, and had a better throw been made toward home, then it really would have worked. But what did you think when that all happened?
Yeah, well, I wasn't surprised because the Dodgers have gone to this kind of fad of shifting this year more than they had in the past, and Seth Smith is the classic example of when you use it. So they would always have three infielders over on that side. And with the winning run on third base, it's not the first time that Don Mattingly has pulled an outfielder in to play the infield because a fly ball is going to win the game anyway. So he had already put in Andre Ethier, who has had some first base experience. And it just made sense that they would do it that way. But I guess because they were sort of equidistant apart in a straight line, it looked amazing, you know, because no one's really ever seen anything like that. And Wallach said, you know, it made sense to him as long as you're going to have the extra infielder in, and you're playing him to pull anyway. Just keep them evenly spaced and hope that the one of those balls goes right to him, and maybe you can get a double play and get out of the inning. Which they actually did get the ground ball, and D. Gordon fielded it cleanly, and then he almost threw it away, and it was a phenomenal dig by catcher A.J. Ellis just to get the one out at the plate, but they weren't able to get the double play, and they wind up losing on the next batter anyway with a hit. But the strategy seemed to work, and I guess you might see that more often when you've got a dead pull left-handed hitter up. I'm sure the Dodgers now will be using it again. I'm sure they hope they don't get into those situations where the game's on the line and they have to get a double play. But, it worked, and Wallach did get the credit for it.
Well, I thought it was pretty humorous and entertaining to watch it from a distance, of course. And finally, so we've seen Mattingly has manipulated the rotation a little bit, so he's got his heavy hitters going against, he's got it kind of lined up to have the top of the rotation go against the Giants, the weekend after this upcoming one. So that has to be kind of nice for the Dodgers to have the ability to sort of juggle things around and make sure that they have their best going against the team that they're trying to beat in the division.
Well, I understand the strategy there. Of course, it's all kind of dependent on Carlos Frias pitching well Wednesday in his first major league start. So, it's not a slam dunk that this thing will work. Because they could lose the game to the Nationals and lose the game in the standings anyway. But assuming that they get a decent start out of him, then it will look like a pretty solid move because they will be lined up. And in addition to that, they'll be giving pitchers like Ryu and like Greinke an extra day rest, which in both their cases will benefit them. Ryu always pitches better with extra rest, and Greinke with his elbow it probably wouldn't hurt. Of course, Kershaw seems to be indestructible right now, even though he missed 6 weeks early in the season with that back injury. But since then, he's come back, and he looks like he could pitch every 3 days. But they feel that with Dan Heron now, he seems to be back on track, and they're getting occasional decent starts out of Roberto Hernandez, that they feel like this is it's a risk worth taking with the rookie starter. And if they can get through this, of course, they need a big start out of Kershaw tonight, and then if they get the start out of Frias Wednesday, then they'll be set up when they go into San Francisco.
Well, the Dodgers are still ahead at the top of the division, but it's only a couple of games, so this is getting a little bit tight, which is of course what as fans everybody likes to see. So thank you, Ken. We will check in with you next week. Appreciate your time. Let's bring in Chris Haft and get the latest on what is going on with the Giants, Chris. The ongoing storyline, which is Tim Lincecum having sort of been booted from the rotation, sort of to save himself and maybe try to get back on track. Meanwhile, his replacement in Petit, he fits really well in his first audition and is getting another start. So I guess just kind of talk a little bit about that. And it's got to be nice for the Giants to have made this move, and it created a lot of ripple through the clubhouse and through the fan base. But at least it worked, and so far.
Yes, that's right, Allison. In the off season, they knew Yusnero Petit would be an important guy to retain. Late last year, he won 4 out of 5 starts, including a near perfect game. He was one strike away in a game in early September against the Arizona Diamondbacks when Eric Chavez hit a 2-strike pitch in the right field for a single, and there went Yusnero's shot at baseball immortality. Yet, the Giants don't need immortality from him. They just want, adequacy. And he certainly has been that when – he certainly was more than adequate when he started last week in his first outing replacement of Tim. As I remember, off the top of my head, 1 run in 6, plus innings. And, they hope for somewhat near that tonight in Coors Field. Of course, it's a tougher place to pitch. So, they've got to take that into consideration. But they like the depth that Petit gives them. And every team, I think, needs a sixth, quote-unquote, sixth starter. And now the Giants are calling upon theirs.
So what's going on with Lincecum? What is the latest on him? I think the last time we talked, he was sort of working toward making an actual appearance out of the bullpen. And now that it's September 1st, of course, they don't have to maneuver any kind of like 25-man roster situations, but which makes it a little bit easier. But what is what's the latest on him?
Well, he did pitch on Sunday, and he was very rusty, and as can be expected, they're just looking for another opportunity to get him in a game. I mean, if Petit is ineffective, you know, Tim might become the long guy, the long reliever, and you might see Tim coming in the third or fourth inning as Yusmeiro did before when a starter would get injured or just be ineffective. So, you know, it's, with Tim, when he wasn't pitching so bad, it was a work in progress. Now it's even more of a work in progress, I would say.
Well, it's an interesting thing for, I mean, this stuff usually doesn't happen to a team that actually has a legitimate chance to win the World Series, but that's why good teams have depth and are able to muddle through some of this. I was looking at the call-ups for the Giants, a bunch of people I've never heard of, but one that had a very interesting last name in Bochy. So right-handed pitcher Brent Bochy, who would be the son of Bruce Bochy. So he's up along with Gary Brown and a couple other guys. So that's a really cool storyline. That's a great thing to write about. That's got to be a little nerve-wracking, though, for the manager and the player, I would think.
Yeah, it can be. What's in this situation, I think will make it more tolerable is that Brett, Bruce's son, has been in big league camp in spring training each of the last 2 years. So people are used to having him around, having Brett around. Brett's, maybe I'll sound a little paternalistic myself here, but Brett's a good kid. He really is. You know, he doesn't do anything to embarrass his father. Follows the rules, runs his sprints hard, that sort of thing. And, I think that makes it, that makes a potentially touchy situation a lot less touchy. I've covered teams with father-son combos before. Early on when I covered the Giants, Moises Alou was playing for Felipe, and back in my Cincinnati Reds days, Aaron Boone played for his father, Bob. There were instances here and there, maybe a little bit of tension, but for the most part, things went very smoothly, and I think I see no reason why they shouldn't go smoothly here with Brett and Bruce.
It's very cool, and I'm sure that everyone will handle it well. And, of course, you know, Bruce Bochy is a veteran manager who knows what he's doing. So, but it's one thing for spring training. It's quite another when it's September and it's intense and the team is in a pennant race. And he's a dad. And so when he calls upon his son, of course, he's not going to be, like, put in these, like, extremely crucial situations. But he might get into, a game here and there. And so I would think that Bruce Bochy would just be, his heart is like swelling because he's so proud. And then he's also like trying to manage, there's gotta be a lot of emotions, I guess, that are probably going to go through his mind, having this intensity of trying to lead his team through a pennant drive and also just the proud papa watching his son pitch in the major league.
Allison, I think you're absolutely correct. My mind leaps to another instance I witnessed firsthand. In 2004, my one and only year covering the Oakland A's, Chris Spire was the team's bench coach, and they were playing Toronto, I believe, and Justin Spire, his son, was pitching. And I think it was a tie score. Justin gave up a run in the ninth inning, got the loss, and Chris admitted afterward he was just absolutely torn. I don't know how happy A's brass was with him, but he admitted having decidedly mixed feelings, almost kind of rooting against the team that employed him, so his son, so they wouldn't succeed at the expense of his own flesh and blood. So you're right. It can be a tough situation. But in this case, I don't, as you said, I don't think Brett's going to be put in any high leverage situations. Bruce is going to let the guys who've handled it all year handle those situations. And so that will avoid potential problems, I think.
Yeah. I think that it's good that they're probably both on the same side. It makes It makes for, let's admit it. We're looking for stuff to write this time of year, so it makes for a great story. Now let's talk a little bit about Jake Peavy, who, that trade, it made a splash, but it wasn't like earth-shattering news when the Giants acquired him. It was kind of moderately shattering news. He has been just awesome in his last four starts combined, just giving up four earned runs. Came close to a no-hitter the other day against the Milwaukee Brewers, who are a pretty good team from, you know, from what they've done over the course of the season. So just want to get your general thoughts on just what a lift he has been and the addition and his experience, in crucial games and in postseasons and just everything. I mean, Jake Peavy is pretty much the exact guy that you'd want on a team at this point.
Totally. That's why that is indeed, for those reasons you mentioned, that's why they acquired him. They're going to continue to need him down the stretch, no doubt. Whether he can maintain this kind of effectiveness, I don't know. If he does, wow. That will indeed make up for the loss of Matt Cain, which is why they went out and got Jake Peavy in the first place. I could get it, maybe getting ahead of myself to think about what they'll do in this off season with Peavy. I think they'll, at this rate, I wouldn't be surprised if they try to re-sign him, because they'll need to replenish that rotation for next year. But he's a great figure in the clubhouse. Jake is. And on the field and in the dugout, he's somebody with his intensity, people rally around that and respond to it. For all those reasons, he's been an excellent acquisition.
Do you feel like things are coming together for the Giants? I mean, when you kind of look ahead, I'm looking for a crystal ball that doesn't exist, but for everything, the ups and downs and everything, it seems like they're in a pretty good place right now.
They are in a pretty good place. Ask me again tomorrow. I mean, it's funny when we have our weekly chats, you and I, and it seems like one week they're up and the next week they're down. And, yesterday they missed, and it was kind of up and down yesterday all in one day. They won the completion of the suspended game. They won the game that was suspended. But then they lost a regularly scheduled game 10-9, and they could have narrowed the deficit separating them from the Dodgers to one game if they had won that, if they had held on to win that game. So they would have had a much better grip on the first wild card spot if that had happened, if they had won. It wasn't a be-all and end-all day, but it was the kind of day where, in a pennant race, you like to have things go your way. And so, again, they missed an opportunity, but playing it, even though the Rockies have the worst record in the National League, this Coors Field here is never an easy place to play. So the Giants will have their hands full the next two nights, and they go to Detroit. That should be an intriguing series, a rematch of the 2012 World Series. And then they get some home games. So, they need to try and take advantage of every little possibility here.
Yeah, I'm still not used to interleague play in September, but it just seems weird to me that they'd be playing the Tigers in September, but it is what it is. And the Giants do have the best ballpark food in their favor, so, and that's important to some of us. So thank you, Chris Haft, and we'll be chatting with you next week. Thank you. Let's bring in Corey Brock to discuss some of these people for the Padres. Corey, speaking of Corey's, there's been another Corey Spangenberg, who has debuted recently, and he was the 10th overall pick in 2011 from a draft that looks to be a pretty significant one. If you're talking about some of the guys that came from that draft, Garrett Cole, Anthony Rendon, George Springer, Jose Fernandez, Sonny Gray, Colton Wong, names that we hear a lot now. And of course, Spangenberg seems to be up and coming also. So, he made a jump from AA, which is kind of unusual. But let's talk a little bit about where the Padres see him long-term. They seem to want him to improve versatility, play some different positions. Where do you see him ultimately ending up in the big leagues?
Yeah, kind of a little different path for Spangenberg. He had a couple of concussion issues in the minor leagues, one last year and one this year, and the Padres have been very cautious about that. He repeated a level. Went back to the Texas League this year, which, for listeners who aren't really familiar with minor league baseball, is a league really geared toward pitching. You look at the offensive numbers there, and they're pretty well suppressed across the league. The last time I looked, there were only two guys that finished above 300 hitters in that league, and Corey didn't have enough at-bats to qualify for the batting league title, but finished above 300 there. But, he, you know, they like him a lot. He's a, you know, left-handed hitter, profiles as, you know, a bat-first guy who will take a walk, can run well, has been a second baseman, has bounced around the infield when he was younger in college and such. But, you know, recently this year, Allison, they've asked him to play a little third base. They've asked him to play a little outfield. Not so much with, and this is where I think fans, maybe there's some confusion, not so much to gear him for an ultimate role as a utility guy, but to increase his versatility and maybe to help him get to the big leagues a little quicker. Well, he got to the big leagues pretty quick this September, and, you know, obviously the roster's expanded, so they get a chance to get a look at him. They had to put him on the 40-man roster this year anyway, and they were going to do that. So, ultimately, you know, I don't know exactly, you know, if this will increase his chances of making the opening day roster next year or not. But he's going to get a chance to play a lot here in September. He made two nice plays at third base the other day. It should be noted he only played 7 games at third base as a professional all this year. Looked very good there his first day. Natural second baseman, but again, he could play a little outfield as well and hit a walk-off home run in his second big league game. So, you know, a young guy to keep an eye on and, you know, a kind of a guy for Padre fans to look forward to for years to come.
And I guess I was saying his name wrong. So it's Spangenberg. Thank you very much for that. Sorry, Padres fans. And so I saw one report that sort of projected him to not be a regular down the road. And of course, we don't really know. But and it's funny because he's not a home run hitter, but he certainly has become – you know, endeared himself to the Padres fans pretty early by hitting a walk-off home run. But, you know, having a lack of power doesn't necessarily make you not be able to be like a regular starter. And some of these reports I'm saying that he projects as a utility guy. But you're saying, no, that there could be, you know, more of a future for him.
Yeah, and I think the point is that at 23 that it's probably just too soon to close the door on him and ultimately make the call on what he's going to be as a big leaguer. I think that's probably a little short-sighted for fans or for others, and maybe even for people in the game itself. I think you have to take a little bit longer look. Like I said, you know, the last 2 years, you know, kind of been cut a little short in terms of the concussion and playing time and all that, but took a big step forward this year. And you know, again, you know, increasing the versatility that could help him, you know, if he does eventually settle in as a utility guy. Certainly in the National League, that utility spot, the bench spot, is a lot more important, a lot more prevalent than it is in the American League. He possesses some nice things for a National League bench. It's the ability to take a walk, the ability to run, a left-handed bat off the bench. But, you know, again, I don't think the Padres are really willing to pigeonhole this guy into a bench spot just yet. I still think that they're willing to see where this is able to take him with you know, frequent at-bats, and maybe he'll get a chance to do that this month.
So another interesting guy, Tyson Ross. So 14 straight quality starts, 6 or fewer hits allowed in each of those. That's pretty remarkable. You don't see that a ton. You'd think that just one sort of mediocre start would sneak in there, but it seems to be not the case with him. So that has to be nice as they're looking to, you know, looking toward the future with their starting rotation to have him kind of anchoring right in the middle. I would imagine that they're feeling pretty good about that.
Yeah, I keep referring to him, Allison, as the best 12-loss pitcher in baseball. certainly, what you can't really control that. You know, he was the victim early on, a really poor run support, and this is, you know, early in the year when the Padres had a lot of underperformance. I know we talked about it in earlier podcasts about how, you know, having so many guys hitting well below their career average all at once really, really handicapped this team early on, and also injuries, but mostly underperformance. But, you know, they've been scratching out a few more runs for Tyson, and he's been making it hold up. And, you know, the innings, he's approaching 200 innings. He's made 29 starts. He's been extremely durable. You look at the, you know, I think the telltale sign, again, is the number of starts, it's the innings, it's the hits-to-innings ratio, which is really good, the high strikeouts, he's cut down on the walks, and, you know, I think, you know, you can't say it enough that you really have to credit former general manager Josh Burns for making a pretty smart deal with the A's and getting Tyson Ross a couple years ago for a couple of minor league guys where, maybe the A's are ready to, maybe it's just time for a change of scenery, and not that the A's have suffered too greatly, but Ross has really flourished here. He gives a lot of credit to Buddy Black and the pitching coach Darren Balsley for, you know, helping him with his mechanics and maybe the mental side, but, you know, a lot of it falls on Tyson's shoulders, and he's been durable. He's been very good. He may have one of the best sliders in baseball, and you know, Allison, I think if he's not playing for the Padres, we're talking about him a lot more, and probably people across the industry are talking about him a lot more.
Yeah, sometimes the players that are shining for teams that nobody's really paying a lot of attention to on the national scale don't really get, you know, enough attention. We're kind of seeing that in Houston. Jose Altuve is putting together just a ridiculous season, and the only people who are talking about it are in Houston. So that just kind of goes with the territory, especially when it comes to this time of year when there's so many really interesting division races and pennant races. Speaking of which, the Dodgers, I mean, I don't really believe, like, in moral victories, but at the same time, I'm sure the Padres had to enjoy a little bit just being able to sort of get things together when they're playing the Dodgers. They just lost their first 8 of the first 11 that they played to L.A., but then they won 3 of their next 5. So good timing, and I would imagine that they had to feel pretty good about themselves to be able to, you know, a very intense Dodgers team that is embroiled in a very tough pennant race right now, to be able to sort of play spoiler a little bit has to help their confidence.
Yeah, and it really played well against the Dodgers lately and had a very tough series up there here not too long ago, about 10 days or so ago, and had a really good matchup with Ross against Kershaw. And, you know, Ross matched Kershaw pitch for pitch and actually had a late lead and gave up a home run to Justin Turner there. Then that was able to allow Kershaw to extend that wonderful run that he's on. But just kind of goes to show you the impressive run that that Tyson Ross is on as well. But yeah, they're playing a lot better against their division foes. They get one more series against the Dodgers coming up here. Got a lot of NL West games on the schedule in the month of September. And while the Padres aren't going to win the division title, you know, I think they're going to have a say certainly in how this thing finishes up. It's been interesting to watch those two teams at the top, Allison, kind of go on these mini runs and these mini slumps that they've been on. Now the Giants, who couldn't seem to score very many runs to save their lives, are now putting up multiple runs. So it's going to be a wild finish in the NL West. And like I said, I think the Padres are going to have a big hand in how this thing all finishes up.
Does it matter how they end as far as Bud Black's status? I know he's got the club holds an option on his contract for 2015, and if I'm not mistaken, there's nothing beyond that. So do you think that this will be resolved? I don't want to have a weekly conversation on Bud Black's job security, but we haven't talked about it in a few weeks, so we might as well throw it out there. But do you feel like this will be resolved soon after the season's over, that he'll know one way or another?
Yeah, no, the 15 option was picked up a ways back. So, he's good to go. He's fine through 15. And, you know, I don't know necessarily if the new general manager, A.J. Preller, has to necessarily come out and say that, hey, Bud Black is our manager, just because he is under contract through next year. You know, maybe at some point as you get closer to spring training, and certainly maybe before you get into the season, you maybe have to address that, whether it's a contract extension or make some sort of decision moving forward in terms of, you know, are we going to extend this guy? You don't want a manager certainly to be a lame duck guy lingering too long into the 2015 season. This is still kind of a getting-to-know period for A.J. Preller, not just with front office staff, player development, and the major league roster, but also his manager. And I know they've spent a lot of time together in the past few weeks or so. They've had dinner when we were on the road in Arizona a couple weeks ago. And, you know, kind of getting to know each other. I know A.J. has said he's enjoyed his conversations with Buddy, and I know the opposite to be true as well. So, you know, I think there's a recognition that Buddy does a very good job, has a very good handle of the pulse of that clubhouse, has done a, you know, remarkable job with what he's had to work with in his 8 years in San Diego. And, you know, I think a very bright individual who has a very good handle on the game, the National League game, how it's run, how to set up a bullpen, and a pretty good handle on position players as well, much more so than he did his first year. I think he's grown as a manager. I think he's a really good one, and I think I'll just put it this way. If Bud Black was ever out of work, he would probably have another deal lined up in the time it took him to get into his car and start the engine. So I think that, you know, at least for the time being, I think he's fine in San Diego. We'll see where this all ultimately where this goes. But, you know, it seems to be working out so far, the relationship between the new general manager and Bud Black.
That's good. That's good to hear, because sometimes when it's just a matter of like 1 year or less on the contract, you know, even if they pick up the option, it's if they just don't want him around, then it's not like it's a huge financial loss to just have to pay that 1 year. It's when it becomes, you know, if they're in a multi-year deal, you don't want to cut them loose and have to pay them for, you know, 2+ years. So, but you're feeling pretty good that even with just the 1 year on his contract, that he's got a pretty good chance. He's got a better chance to be here at spring training than to not be here.
Yeah, and regardless of the owing him for a year, I think there's a general sentiment in the front office going up to the top with executive chairman Ron Fowler that you know, people in the organization not only like Buddy a lot, I think they really respect him and understand you know, the shortcomings that he's had to deal with in terms of the major league roster, the bad luck in terms of injuries that they've had. I don't know if it's more so than other teams have had. I certainly don't want to paint a picture where the Padres have been extremely unlucky, even though it may appear that way locally. But, you know, it's been a tough go here in terms of payroll and overall talent on the major league roster, and I have to think that's not lost on people.
Well, at least there'll be some stability there, so that's good. And moving forward, I think that's exactly what the Padres need. So we will keep our eye on things, and thank you, Corey, and we will talk to you next week. Let's bring in Steve Gilbert. Steve, I found it kind of funny, not in, like, I'm sure Trevor Cahill doesn't find it funny, but trying to figure out exactly, you know, who he is and where he fits into this whole thing. The part that I found funny was Miguel Montero's quote about him, just talking about how, although, you know, Cahill's been in the big leagues for 6 years, and it's kind of been a frustrating run for him lately. Montero basically was saying, let's just remember that he's still only 26 years old. And his quote was, he just got to the big leagues too early. I know that he didn't mean like that he shouldn't have been called up when he did. And I think that we all know what he was talking about, but it's been kind of frustrating for Cahill because he racked up the innings in his last few years. And he's really, you know, put some innings on that arm for a young guy. But there's still, trying to understand why he hasn't had like a major breakthrough. So what's your take on all that?
Yeah, I mean, he really, if there has been one guy that's been just frustrating for the Diamondbacks and a guy who is, this season's been a season of frustration, but for Trevor Cahill in particular, it's been a hard one. He's just, you know, ever since he came over in that trade, he put together a pretty decent 2012. 2013 was, you know, okay. Not as good as he was with the A's in 2011. The Diamondbacks really thought when they traded Jared Parker for Cahill before the 2012 season that they were getting somebody that could kind of help put them over the top in terms of their rotation going forward. And he just has struggled to kind of find a consistent arm slot. It's one of those things that has the Diamondbacks kind of racking their brains because he really has a devastating heavy sinker. It's just a matter of trying to get that sinker close enough to the strike zone so if he doesn't get it called for a strike, he's at least getting guys swinging at it. And it's been just kind of a frustration thing for him. They even sent him down to Class A ball earlier this year to kind of try to work on the mechanics and kind of, you know, build him back up from there. And he had some success. He had a run of about 5 straight starts where it seemed like, okay, now he's starting to put things together again. In his last 2, again, the command hasn't been there and the consistent arm slot hasn't been there. And I think Montero was kind of expressing his own kind of frustration when he made those comments because he's trying to find the right thing when Cahill's on the mound to kind of try to get him back on track and just, it's just been hard for anybody to kind of find the magic formula to get him back.
So it'll just continue through the rest of this month, maybe head into spring and still, I mean, they're sticking with him. I'm sure that they feel like he's going to be a part of this club for a while longer. So I guess they just have to sort of ride it out.
Yeah, he's got $12 million. He's owed $12 million next year, so they're desperate.
Oh, he'll be around.
So they're desperate to try to figure something out to kind of try to get, it's not so much get their money's worth, but just to get him back on track so that he can be a usable piece in that rotation and you know, eat the innings that he used to be able to eat when he was with the A's in his first couple of years with the Diamondbacks.
So talk about another extremely frustrated person on a Diamondbacks roster has to be Vidal Nuño, who was acquired in the trade with the Yankees for Brandon McCarthy and is still looking for a win in a Diamondbacks uniform, but has pitched really well enough to have several wins. So it's kind of amazing that he has not won a single game since joining the Diamondbacks. Is this just a head-scratcher?
Yeah, you look at the way he's pitched, and he certainly deserves a better result, and the offense just hasn't been there for him. It's just one of those things that seems to happen. There always seems to be a pitcher or two on the staff who seems to kind of run into tough luck when it comes to run support. But he's a guy that this last month and the last month of the season coming up are important for him because he's kind of establishing himself as a guy that they really need to look at as a possible rotation piece next year. Mike Harkey, who's their pitching coach, was the bullpen coach in New York, and he was the one that recommended Nuño to the front office, liked what he had seen in him while he was with him last year in New York. And so they took a flyer on him when it came time to trade Brandon McCarthy, and they've really kind of been impressed with what they've seen, and now maybe this guy could be a back end of the rotation piece going forward for them.
So looking down the road, I mean, when you look toward 2016 for this club, I mean, they've had some devastating arm injuries, I mean, with a couple, well, several Tommy John surgeries. Do you feel like, and of course losing Goldschmidt was gigantic, do you feel like they have something good in place next year? I mean, I know we talked about it a pretty long time ago, just how they're sort of treading water, and they don't feel like they're going to need to make the gigantic wholesale changes in the offseason because it was more of an injury issue than just having a lack of talent depth. Now that we're entering sort of the end of the season and you've been able to observe, you know, what this team has become since having been so removed from losing these guys to injuries, what do you think heading into next season? Do you think they're in a pretty good position?
Well, I think they probably need to add a piece or two during the winter if they're serious about contending next year. But it certainly seems like it could be a quick kind of rebuild if it's not for next year, maybe the year after, because they do have some young pitching coming up. They do have some young position players that they do like, whether it's Chris Owings or Jake Lamb. A.J. Pollock is now back and healthy. They'll get Goldschmidt back next year. Patrick Corbin, they're going to take their time with after his Tommy John surgery. Probably won't see him until, you know, May or June at the earliest. So there's some potential there. I think that they still probably need to add a pitcher, maybe a bat, depends on what they want to do with Trumbo during the offseason. So they're also planning on having a high payroll again of over $100 million. So there's going to be some expectation that comes along with that. So I think they have a chance to come back, maybe not next year, depending on what they add in the offseason, but certainly in the very near future.
It's got to be kind of tough. I mean, I guess it's not like this division is unique. I mean, every division has a really good team at the top, sometimes more than one, sometimes three. But this is not an easy division on its face. And when you're talking about the Dodgers, who are, you know, just have more money to spend than anybody can imagine, the Giants, who, you know, seem to always be around and just have this great chemistry going. So there's little room for error for anybody else in the division if they really want to be a player at the top.
Yeah, I think you're right, Allison. I think that the Giants are kind of like what the Diamondbacks had hoped to be. They knew they were never going to spend the money that the Dodgers were going to, and not even really what the Giants do. But the Giants, as you mentioned, seem to always kind of be around, and they have this kind of great chemistry, and they have this kind of, I hate to use the word, but grittiness, and they're there at the end. And two out of, you know, the last four World Championships have been won by them. So that's kind of who the Diamondbacks were trying to be this year. Obviously, it didn't work out for a variety of factors. But it is a very tough division. You got the Padres, who are you know, have a pretty good record here since the trade deadline. So there's constant competition here. They're not going to be able to outspend the Dodgers, probably not even the Giants, but they need to be able to develop some of their own players and maybe have the, you know, the sum be greater than the individual parts.
So we need to end on just touching on the alumni game. Is there anybody in particular who stuck out as still being able to bring it?
Well, I'll tell you what. You looked at some of those bodies, and you could tell that they had been retired for a while. But you looked at like Reggie Sanders. You looked at Reggie Sanders, and you looked at Steve Finley and Junior Spivey, and those guys at least looked physically like they could get out there tomorrow and play. I know there's a difference between looking. You know, being in good physical condition and being in baseball shape, but those guys look like they were ready to play. Now, some of the other guys, you know, probably not so much, but those guys at least kind of stood out as guys who have kept themselves in good shape.
Can they still all fit? Like, what were they were just wearing? Kind of like pullover jerseys or. What was the
dress? Some of them actually squeezed themselves into some of those jerseys. They wore Diamondback jerseys. So it was kind of a fun night. You know, they always like to have fun with Luis Gonzalez, and when he came up, they put on one of those exaggerated shifts against him, which kind of had him stepping out of the box and shaking his head in an alumni game. And of course, then he hits a high fly ball to left field where there's nobody within, you know, 30 yards of, and certainly at this stage of their lives, they're not going to be able to track those balls down very quickly. So Gonzo was able to get a double out of it. Mike Fetter sarcastically walked over and handed them the baseball as kind of like a, you know, great, you got a double on a little bloop fly ball in left field. Congratulations, here you go.
Very nice. I was thinking that Mike Fetter might have been one of those guys that perhaps didn't quite look the same in his uniform, but we are not going to get into specifics on that, so we will end it there. But Steve, thank you so much, and we'll check back with you soon and talk about the Diamondbacks. Thank you. Let's bring in Thomas Harding. And Thomas, I'd like to kind of start. It's sort of an interesting thing because now the Rockies are in a position to possibly get the first pick of the draft next year, which is not you know, a source of pride necessarily for a lot of teams. But there does come a point where when you see that the season is sort of a lost season and you have this opportunity to get the first pick, you almost wonder if teams are sort of hoping, not that they want their team to lose, but in a way they maybe don't want them to finish so strongly so that they, because when you have the first pick, it's a larger bonus pool. There's a lot of things with the new rules with the draft that can really benefit the team that has the first pick. So from a Rockies standpoint, just your feeling on it, I mean, do you feel that there's maybe a need for them to grab that worst record in baseball to get that first pick?
You know, I don't see the need for that. Their drafting record hasn't been the best, especially when it's come to pitchers in recent years. John Gray and Eddie Butler and Tyler Anderson down at Tulsa, which is in the playoffs this week, they may be able to reverse that. I think now if you can grab that first pick and you can find a way to lose a few free agents to where you get some other compensatory picks along with a competitive balance pick, I could see where that could be a strategy of sorts. But I don't see that they're going to be celebrating having the first pick. I mean, a couple years ago they had the third pick, and they've been a perennial top 10 picking team. And generally, whether it's the overall number one pick in the draft or someone in the top five or so, you're looking at a very similar player. So I don't think that it's like the NFL where you can draft your franchise quarterback or your franchise pass rusher and know he's that guy and begin using him the following year. I don't think that's necessarily the case in baseball. I think if they're going to be excited about a draft position, they pretty much clinched the top five position right now. So if they're going to be excited about it, they should already be celebrating.
Yeah, I think celebrating.
If that's a celebration. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's true. But I feel like with the new rules and the way that the draft is set up now, that there just aren't as many quote-unquote unsignables as used to be. I mean, there are, I think a lot of the problems with the way that the Pirates drafted for so many years was just that there were so many players that they weren't going to be able to afford to be able to sign, that they had to take all those high picks and draft guys that were signable, and they ended up being disasters. I mean, most of them didn't reach the big leagues, mainly because they just weren't very good players. And I just feel like now the leverage is a lot of that leverage is gone because there's only a certain amount you can spend anyway. And while there's negotiations, it's a lot less than it used to be. And you would think that the lesser teams would maybe benefit from that.
Well, I think they'll benefit to some degree. And if you look at a couple of the drafts that the Rockies have had, they drafted a middle infielder, Ryan McMahon, I believe it was last year, who's turned out to be a pretty good player. What they are able to do in the new slotting system is they pay that first pick, especially if it's a college guy, they paid him a bit under slot and use the rest of that money to sign those compensatory picks or the competitive balance picks. So I think the draft is set up for the strategy that the Rockies have. And, yes, your first pick, if he's the number one overall pick and he's a college guy, maybe you'll have to go two slot on him, and that may affect the ability to sign players lower down. But you're right. It's not going to matter that much. It's not going to decide who you pick, because of the new slotting rules. You can pretty much pick the player you want with the number one overall pick.
Right. Well, let's get back to what's actually going on with the Rockies right now. And there's a 23-year-old pitcher, Tyler Matzek, who's really performing pretty well. I read something interesting on the Rockies' website just about, how much should they push him, how many innings is enough, and the word kind of is that they're not really monitoring him at this point. But he pitched 66 2/3 innings at AAA. He's got 84-plus innings in the major league, so 150 innings. More than he's ever pitched in pro ball. And there's a fine line. You really have to be careful to make sure that they're not overextending themselves, especially in a non-contending season. How much is enough? And do you think that they will just have him pitch throughout for the rest of September?
I think they could have him pitch throughout September, but keep an eye on the pitch count. I do have a concern about this already being the most innings he's ever pitched. But if you look at it this way, he was a 2009 number one draft pick, and it's taken him a while to get here. He has been beaten around a bit. He spent some time in the bullpen. So I think that there may be less concern because of the number of years he has been in the organization. And I think it is showing now that he's actually ready to pitch in the big league. So I can understand why it's less of a concern still. It seems like almost everybody gets hurt. So, do you become careful with him through September? I would see nothing wrong with skipping a start with him in the latter part of September. However, I guess if you're trying not to be the number one draft pick, then maybe you want to throw him out there because he is one of your better pitchers.
Well, I found it pretty entertaining to read some of the coverage on what was going on. There was some very good timing for September 1 to come when it did, meaning that rosters could expand. The Rockies happened to have to play finish up a suspended game from May. And that was nice to have those reinforcements because it's basically like a partial doubleheader. Which is never easy. So I'm sure that the team was pretty happy to have the extra reinforcements just to get through that day.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They had Matt McBride came up, I believe Rafael Ynoa, who I'm not sure if he played yesterday or not, but he's a guy who is a middle infielder that could give them some depth next season. The one thing that hurts them, and I don't think it really hurts them totally, is the fact that Double-A Tulsa's in the playoffs, and there are players there who could be here in the major leagues, but right now it is more important for them to compete for a championship there, pitch with everything on the line, play with everything on the line, than it is to come here with a team that's completely out of it and be part of a full clubhouse of nearly 40 guys. So it does hurt them a little bit. We don't get to see John Gray. We probably won't see Eddie Butler again or Tyler Anderson. But all those guys are high draft picks, and if they're pitching well in October for a team going for a championship, I think that means more. But as for the position players, yes, September 1st came at the right time.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's a spirited debate that I've had with fans here in Houston before. Trying to explain why it's important for players that are being developed through a system to understand what winning means and to have experience having won at some level before they get to the big leagues. For years here, players were being developed, and it was a farm system that was barren, but playing through this, making their way through the system, the ones that did reach the big leagues, had never had any taste of a division race, a championship race, anything in the minor leagues. And it is important for them to come together as a cohesive unit, to understand and to win together and to feel that taste of victory, to understand what it's going to take on the major league level to get to that point too, and to kind of be a little bit more prepared for it, I would think.
I would agree with that. Not necessarily winning in and of itself, I don't think is that important at the minor league level, but here's where it's important. When teams win at any level, there are guys who accept different roles. I mean, everybody that's drafted in the baseball probably batted third or fourth or maybe first on their team. Well, you bat in different positions. Maybe you were asked when you were in college to do one thing, but in the pros you're going to have to do something else, because usually when you break into the majors, you break in at a lower leverage spot in the batting order, or sometimes you break in as a reliever, maybe not pitching the ninth inning, but pitching the all-important sixth or seventh inning. When you learn that in the minor leagues, when you have to do things to win a game that day, I think it makes you more prepared for the major leagues, because you haven't just been passed through the system as a number three or number four hitter. You've had to learn to do different things, because when they call you the big leagues, you don't know what they're going to call you for. You don't know if you're going to be called up to be a backup, a pinch hitter. You don't know if they're going to ask you, hey, I know you've batted second throughout the minors, but we need you in the eighth position. So that's where winning in the minor leagues matters, because when you have a winning mindset, you ask players to do things outside their comfort zone, feeling that they're going to be asked to do that when they get to the major leagues.
That's a very, very good point, and I'm going to now use that as part of my arguments. Thank you, Thomas Harding. See, I learned something today, and appreciate your time. And hey, I don't think we talked about injuries today, so I'm like 2 for 2. So we'll go for 3 for 3 next week. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't want to talk about injuries any more than you do. Believe me, I've seen enough of them. I feel like I need Grey's Anatomy right beside me as I write every story.
Exactly. We'll see what we can do to help you out. Thomas Harding, thank you very much. Thanks for listening to MLB.com Extras, the NL West.